Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-7079, MBI Group, Inc., Appellant versus Credit Frontier du Cameroun et al. Mr. Mussolino for the appellants, Mr. Bemis for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Philip Mussolino for appellants. Your Honors, the Court knows we are here on appeal of the District Court's forum nonconvenience dismissal. We challenge the Court's ruling on two factual categories. The first is whether or not the Court gave sufficient weight to the treatment of Roger Chufa and his wife, Felicite Chufa, in both determining whether or not the forum was available and in balancing the various factors that are taken into account.
Did the court deal at all with the criminal conviction?
It did not, Your Honor.
And I'm not sure if I have the timing exactly right, but am I correct in thinking that arose more than 10 days after the initial entry of the order dismissing?
That's correct, Your Honor. And my client's notice of the conviction came much later after that. But that's true. The original, the judge's original rule in granting the motion and imposing conditions predated the conviction, although it postdated the indictments, the issuance of the indictments themselves.
Okay. So if it was more than 10 days, wasn't it beyond the time for a Rule 59 or 60 motion?
It was beyond the time for what we would have called a 10-day motion that would have told the running of the notice of appeal. That's correct, Your Honor. So our argument would be that it would be, a new fact, and two, it would be, our motion was based on the imposition by the trial court of a condition, namely that the Cameroonian courts accept the case for prosecution. So from our perspective, we weren't disputing the judge's initial ruling because of the imposition of the condition. Our motion was based on the failure of the condition, explicitly said so.
The failure, wait a minute, your motion, what do you mean when you?
Our motion for reconsideration, the first motion for reconsideration, Your Honor.
Did that motion pick up the criminal conviction?
It did, Your Honor, as did the renewed motion for reconsideration.
Okay, so when you say it was based on the unavailability, well, what did you say about it?
Based on two things, Your Honor. When the district court first ruled, he imposed a condition, namely the acceptance by the Cameroonian court.
Right.
We then did two things. One, we filed a lawsuit in Cameroon, which resulted in the clerk fixing the $25 million fee. At which point,
and you didn't challenge that at any point, did you?
The clerk's
the fixing
fee
of the fee.
No, Your Honor, we did not.
Was that possible to challenge that?
Oh, I think it was possible to challenge it. I think it was challenged. It was challenged, as we pointed out in the March hearing before the judge, that the roles, as he referred to it, we were arguing mirror image arguments. We were arguing in the Cameroon that the fee fixed by the clerk was absolute and there was no basis for reducing it. The government was arguing in the Cameroon that there were exceptions to the fee and that the clerk's fixing of the fee could be adjusted based on two of the theories they expounded, first in a surreply and later in the various motions. And the two theories expounded by the government were, one, where the government is a defendant, there is no registry or registration fee, and two, there are circumstances where the fee could be reduced. Although, as our experts point out, the fee can't be reduced unless you can establish, one, that you're a private person, and two, that you're impecunious. That is to say, the fee is reduced because you're indigent or otherwise. The district court expressly said it can't resolve that issue and chose not to resolve that issue. And with respect to the second issue, the government is a defendant, we addressed that in detail. As we established, it occurred in our discovery motions, the CFC, one of the defendants in the case, had won a case in which it fixed the fee at 5%. Its own articles and bylaws established that it would pay taxes as the general population paid taxes. And we had two experts who made clear that the statute, so far as they read it, did not excuse the payment of the registry fee merely because one or more of the defendants was a public company or the government of the Cameroon. Well, below, the district court decided he did not need to resolve that issue. All he said was there was a colorable basis for the argument being made by Cameroon, that in fact the fee could have been reduced in some respect. Our position is the court deferred ruling on whether or not the conditions were met while it awaited the ruling of the court in Cameroon in the first place, and then a second time while it awaited the written opinion of the court explaining its dismissal of the proceedings in the Cameroon. When the Cameroonian court issued its decision in writing, and it was a lengthy decision, our position with the district court was that it was clear that the Cameroonian court had heard all of the arguments that could be made for purposes of reducing the fee and had rejected them. It did not vacate the calculation by the clerk in any means or manner. It left standing the calculation by the clerk.
Didn't the Cameroon court also refuse to consider the case because of your refusal to, quote, return the writ?
Correct, Your Honor. That was one of the two
arguments. Well, even if you're right about the fee, isn't this in and of itself enough to justify the district court's decision?
No, Your Honor, because the Cameroonian court did not suggest that one or the other would cure the defects. Both defects had to be cured. Both the filing fee had to be paid and the writ had to be returned. And the writ...
But even if the fee was paid, if you didn't return the writ, you couldn't bring the case, correct?
The case could not proceed.
Could not proceed, and you refused to return the writ.
Right,
why isn't that enough to sustain the district court's decision?
Because, according to Mr. Nkana, the writ, who is the lawyer who represented my client in the Cameroon, the filing of the writ is only appropriate after you transmit the fees that permits the case to go forward. So I'll say this much, Your Honor. If the filing fee had been reduced to within a range that was payable or reasonably payable or otherwise satisfied this court's or other circuit court standards for reasonable filing fees, either in the context of availability or in the context of the balancing of the factors, then at that point it seems to me the court is correct. It could say, well, the only reason you're not going forward in the Cameroon, and this is setting aside the corruption issues that are the second half of our argument, is because you're refusing for no good reason to return the writ. I agree with you there, Your Honor. If at that point, having gotten the filing fee eliminated and having resolved the corruption fees, corruption issues, and having resolved the question raised by Mr. Ancona, which is that if the filing fee is improperly reduced and you then proceed and prevail on judgment, you can still have your judgment vacated if the filing fee is determined that it was improperly refused. But the core issue, clearly the core issue before the Cameroonian court, wasn't whether or not Mr. Nkana held on to the writ instead of turning it over. It was whether or not the filing fee could be reduced under the...
Well, no, the key question is whether, according to the way the district court put it, is whether you in good faith sought to get the Cameroonian court to hear the case, and he concluded you didn't.
Correct.
And we're reviewing this for abuse of discretion, right?
Well, that's the way the district court ultimately phrased it. But as I said, Your Honor, when we were at the March hearing, when the court deferred awaiting the ruling or the explanation of the ruling from the Cameroonian court, it was clear that the roles had been reversed in Cameroon. And we made no secret, Your Honor, of our belief that even if we were allowed to go forward making it past the first step in Cameroon, there was going to be no fair hearing from
us. And there we need to tread carefully, don't we? This court needs to tread very carefully when passing judgment on courts of other sovereigns. And you've made an allegation that the executive of Cameroon had a vendetta against, is it pronounced Mr. Chufa?
Chufa is correct.
Mr. Chufa as well. But how does that show impartiality of the judiciary? That's the inquiry before us. And the State Department report upon which you rely concedes that progress has been made in that area.
Progress is always being made, Your Honor, but the question is whether progress is sufficient to enable the parties to get some version of a fair hearing, even if it's not identical to the hearing you're going to get in the United States.
And so what evidence, what do you allege to suggest that the judiciary would be impartial?
I understand
your argument about the executive has something out for him.
Well, our argument, the behavior of the judiciary in this case, Your Honor, including entering the default against both Mr. Chufa and against his wife on what we obviously believe, and I think the record makes clear, are obviously trumped up and groundless charges.
Well, wasn't there contradictory evidence to that in the record?
There were
affidavits to the contrary.
No, Your Honor. Here, let me give you the issues that were raised, as I understand it, by the Cameroon. First, the Cameroon argues that Mr. Adu, who was the former manager of CFC before he was removed and replaced by Mr. Akinde, had a secret interest through his brother-in-law, a Mr. Gabriel, unknown to CFC at the time, through a company called The Falls, which in turn had a minority interest in the Atlantic Group, which in turn was the Cameroonian partner of the American company that's one of the two plaintiffs here. And what the record makes very clear by the admission of the defendants themselves is that the relationship between Mr. Gabriel and Mr. Adu was known to everyone at CFC because, among other things, Mr. Gabriel's daughter worked at CFC, and Mr. Gabriel's relationship to the Falls was a matter of public record because they rely on those very public records to allege that there's corruption against Mr. Adu. Now, we, as our affidavit shows, were not given access by the Cameroonian government to Mr. Adu, nor were we, and we have an affidavit from our Cameroonian lawyer who went to try to interview him, nor were we given discovery by the district court in two respects. But even under their version of events, they have to concede that they understood both pieces of the puzzle. Their second contention is that there was a house purchased by Atlantic, and Mr. Adu collected rents, they say, and therefore that's some indication of corruption either by him or Mr. Chufa. But as Mr. Chufa explained in our opposition to their first motion to dismiss, the house was purchased by Atlantic Group for the use of the Group 5 entity that was a South African construction company. It was purchased specifically for the purpose of giving them a facility where they would live. And the only time Mr. Adu ever collected the rent was after CFC terminated him, because Mr. Adu lived near where the house was, or his family lived near where the house was. And Mr. Chufa, as he says in the declaration, asked him to go pick up the rent once. Those are the two basic allegations. The allegations against Ms. Chufa, the wife, are that her company somehow got a hold of the money that was paid to the Atlantic Group and used it to purchase a house with Mr. Chufa.
This was a default conviction, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right, so I'm not sure why any of these details make a difference. The question that Judge Griffith put was about the involvement of the judiciary. So it seems to me the burden here is for you to say that this was not the way in which a default conviction would have been handled by the judiciary in an unbiased situation. Well, what evidence is there of that?
My position, Your Honor, is that the default, including not allowing Mr. Chufa's lawyer to appear in the default prosecutions, is the evidence was so transparently inadequate that the judiciary played a role in the harassment of Mr. and Mrs. Chufa.
That seems to be relevant only if you've shown that in an ordinary default conviction it would be different.
And in the State Department report, of course.
No, that doesn't go to this case. What is it in the record about the Cameroonian law on default convictions that says that ordinarily the lawyer would be allowed to appear and anything else would have been different than it was handled in this case?
Well, I can't say that the law would have been any different, Your Honor. All I can say is
Then how can we say the judiciary is implicated?
All I can say, Your Honor, is that the role of the judiciary so far in this case, as it's directed at Mr. Chufa, has resulted in him being sentenced to 40 years for what are clearly groundless charges. And you can say, well, the judiciary is entitled to enter a 40-year prison sentence for somebody because he doesn't appear. But my argument would be, when the charges are so transparently groundless and so transparently retaliatory.
Well, forgetting retaliatory, does the judiciary dismiss apparently groundless allegations in default cases?
In the Cameroon, Your Honor? I don't think there's any. I can't say I can point to anything in the record that says that.
We don't know.
No, Your Honor. But I'd still argue that the court can look to the conduct of both the executive and the judiciary where it appears, as the State Department says, that the executive exerts undue influence over the judiciary, and say, particularly in a case where here it's a forum non-convenience motion to begin with, and the plaintiff is deemed to be suing in his own forum. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your time is up. Do you want to hear the rest of it? Okay.
Thank you.
We'll give you a minute for rebuttal, Mr.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Knox Bemis, representing the appellees in this case. First of all, on the Cameroon court proceeding involving the court deposit, it is clear, and I think we have that spelled out very completely in our brief, that the plaintiffs in their action in that court had the right to have the amount of the fee reviewed by the court. They did everything they could to avoid court review.
And, well, and you did everything you could on the other side of that, right? I mean, well, the argument was fully presented.
Well, we argued that the court deposit should be reduced. However, the court in the end held that it had no jurisdiction to hear the matter because of the filing fee and because the plaintiff's attorney had withheld the original of the writ.
What's your reaction to counsel's argument that the writ wasn't relevant at this point because of the filing fee? In other words, the writ didn't have to be returned until a lower filing fee was set.
Your Honor, I think that the critical fact is that...
Well, is he right about that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure of the answer to that, but it doesn't make any difference.
Why?
Because the Cameroon Code provides that if there's a dispute about the amount of the court deposit, the court will set the amount of the deposit. The plaintiff has a right to get that heard, and the answer obviously is that he can get that heard before filing the contested court deposit. Otherwise, you couldn't.
Okay, but that's not inconsistent with his argument that not until the court set the deposit is he required to return the writ. So in other words, his point is that, look, this really, these aren't two independent grounds for the Cameroonian court's decision. It really rests on the deposit question, not the return of the writ. Because the obligation to return the writ only would have occurred, according to counsel, if the Cameroon court had reduced the deposit and it had paid it. Then it would have had to return the writ. Well, am I understanding that correctly?
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact, though, is that in refusing to return the writ, the plaintiffs were doing everything they could to avoid a ruling by the Cameroon court on the amount of the court deposit. Whether that argument of plaintiff's counsel is correct or not, the fact is that they were successful in precluding the court review of the amount of the deposit, which they were entitled to get, that is, the review they were entitled to get, if they had sought it, under the Cameroon Code. So our position is that the plaintiffs deliberately avoided having the court review as the plaintiffs were entitled to have, the review of the amount of the court deposit. And as I say, I believe although the defendants there did argue that the amount of the deposit should be reduced, the court didn't reach that question. The court ruled in favor of plaintiffs. It accepted the plaintiff's argument there. On the treatment of Roger Chufa and the prosecution, there are several things. First of all, in a quick review of the plaintiff's request for reconsideration, motion for reconsideration under Rules 59E and 60B, I find no reference to the conviction of Roger Chufa and his wife. The argument in that motion based on Chufa is as follows. This is the argument heading. The unavailability in Cameroon of MBI's representative precludes dismissal. That argument that was raised in the motion, and I believe both their motions are essentially the same, the argument that was raised in their motion to the district court has now somehow morphed into an argument that the treatment of the Chufas shows that the Cameroon courts would be biased against plaintiffs. And
You said that the conviction doesn't show up as a ground in the motion.
Correct.
But it hadn't occurred yet.
Well, it occurred, yes. I think the conviction occurred. Yes, it had occurred.
Before the filing of the motion for
I'm looking here at the motion filed April 20th, 2009, which is document 54 in the court record.
2009?
Yes. That's the second motion.
Second motion. Okay. Right. So the first time it hadn't occurred. Second, by the time of the second motion, it had. It seemed to me, in looking and tracing this, that the plaintiffs raised it in their for the first time in the court-ordered surreply, and that was also the first time they could possibly have raised it, given the timing.
I believe we addressed that in our surreply, and the
yes, it's in their reply and your surreply.
Right,
I have it here now.
Right. That could be my point. My point is their motion for reconsideration did not rely upon this as a ground for.
Well, but if they raised it when they first could, what's the relevance of that observation?
Well, what they're appealing here is the court's denial of their motion for reconsideration, and the
conviction occurred before that.
Yes.
Is that your point?
Yeah. Yes.
And that's the only thing before us, right?
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. Well, I'd like to.
All right, go ahead.
I was going to say I'd like to address the charges that the conviction of Roger Chufa was unjustified and retaliatory. It was not. The prosecution conviction of the Chufas was fully warranted. First place, there is undisputed evidence of conduct by Roger Chufa that warrants the prosecution conviction. Roger Chufa provided the general manager of CFC, or his brother-in-law, with a 45% interest in the developer of the project for a nominal amount, $1,800. In other words, you have a situation where the developer of a multi-million dollar project has given the general manager of the financing agency a 45% interest in the developer. The plaintiffs have not brought forth anything that attempts to justify that. The most they have said is that CFC should have been able to find out about that. They did not, in fact, disclose this to CFC. Their argument is that CFC should have been able to find out about it by looking at the records of the Corporation of the Falls, which were in the possession of the notary public that had organized the corporation. But it's a transaction that by its nature could not be cured by disclosure in any event. So there was ample basis for prosecution of Roger Chufa, and there were other circumstances as well. The transfer of the house to that same corporation, the Falls, with the house being paid for by Atlantic. Retaliation. There is no record evidence that the prosecution of the Chufas was in retaliation. There is no record evidence that Chufa made charges of being solicited for bribes until the complaint in this case was filed in April 2007. The brief of plaintiffs is replete with assertions that the prosecution was retaliatory, but there is no record evidence that it was so. The only suggestion prior to the filing of the complaint in this case in the record is not from Roger Chufa, it's from plaintiff's attorney, and it has a veiled suggestion there of graft and corruption. The prosecutions were in accordance with Cameroon law. They were default judgments. The plaintiffs would be entitled to a trial de novo. Most important, the plaintiffs also keep repeating that the Chufas were sentenced to hard labor. There is no record support for that, and it's false. Cameroon has no law that authorizes hard labor.
Have you seen the judgment?
Yes, indeed.
And it doesn't make reference?
It does not. Here's the plaintiffs introduced a copy in English of a purported sentencing order. The Cameroon court issues its orders in French. We provided the copy of the original French judgment. The phrase there used is imprisonment ferme. That doesn't mean hard labor. That means simply that the sentences are not commuted. This is all in our brief, by the way. But the problem is that plaintiff keeps asserting that their sentence was hard labor when that is simply not the fact. And not only that, it's been pointed out to them what the error is, and they have not come forward with any Cameroon statute that would authorize it. They haven't challenged our original version of the sentencing order, and they have not challenged our translation of it.
Where is this in the judgment?
The joint appendix at pages 240 through 242, and it is discussed in Mr. Muna's declaration at paragraph 34.
Well, let me stay at 242. Where do we find the imprisonment ferme?
On page 242. Actually, for Roger Chufa, it's on page 243. You note that everyone is, or almost everyone, is mm-hmm. designated imprisonment ferme. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Muna discusses this at paragraph 34 of his declaration, second declaration. That's at the joint appendix 226, 227. In reference to the Cameroon courts, perhaps the best example of the way the Cameroon courts approach this is the proceeding involving the court deposit itself. In that proceeding, the plaintiffs came forward. The attorney freely espoused and argued the position of plaintiffs. The court, after consideration, held in favor of plaintiffs. It is difficult to argue on the basis of that the Cameroon courts are biased against the plaintiffs. If the courts in Cameroon were biased in favor of the government and against the plaintiffs, you would have expected to see either a decision for the government or a consideration of the amount of the court deposit, or at the very least some
acknowledge that has been a problem historically, quite apart from this case, which we're focusing on. It has been a problem historically. State Department acknowledges that.
There are State Department reports of this. There are contrary reports. We have affidavits in the record, one from an attorney, Mr. Wolver, who has represented a number of foreign clients in Cameroon courts and who reports that he has had no problem with the justice in those courts. So it's there are the State Department reports. Yes, that's true. But I submit that the best example of whether the courts are biased against the plaintiffs here comes from the proceeding that is before this court. The full record is before this court. That is where the Cameroon courts held in favor of plaintiffs and.
It is fair to say, though, is it not, that the State Department report here is more specific than was true in the report in the El Fadl case?
In the which?
In the El Fadl case. On which the district judge relied. The district court seems to have read Alfadl as being a kind of a bar to considering a report from the State Department, but the report here was, as I say, more specific.
Well, there are other cases in other countries involved, and some with far more serious problems than the State Department reports from Cameroon. But there are a number of problems been pointed out with State Department reports. They are they're compiled in a way that doesn't permit examination or going behind them. They are general in their terms. If you look at them, they tend to be the same from year to year.
General is a matter of degree. In the Alfadl report, it was that there are concerns about corruption in the judiciary in whatever country. It was Jordan. Here, it's that the judiciary is dominated by the executive. Quite different.
I submit that, although more specific, it's still general, and I submit that...
It's not specific to these parties or this case.
Right. And if you look at what happened with these parties in the case that has occurred in Cameroon, you find it a very different situation.
Thank you. Unless there are further questions?
No, I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bemis. Mr. Michelino, you want to take a minute? And in particular, while you're at it, tell me about Fermé versus Travaux Force.
Tell you about, pardon me, Your Honor?
Fermé versus Travaux Force.
Which circuit, Your Honor?
No. imprisonment
French.
Versus hard labor.
See, I just accept. No. That's my ignorance, Your Honor. Our translation is on page 430, and we translated it as hard labor. And I don't know the answer to the correct translation, Your Honor, except to say that Mrs. Chufa was sentenced to 30 years, whether hard labor or not, and Mr. Chufa was sentenced to 40 years.
Well, there's nothing about Fermé that suggests hard labor, is there?
As Your Honor, it's. I profess absolutely no knowledge about French, but as I say, that's the translation we got. It was certified.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. The certification?
Mm-hmm. And the translation?
I'm not sure it's in the joint appendix, but all of the translations were accompanied by a certification, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't answer your French question, as evident from the fact that I didn't understand that you were speaking French at the time.
That was good evidence.
I don't want to re-argue the chronology except to say there's really no way in this record. And the trial court didn't do it. The district court didn't do it to suggest that what was happening here is the corrupt people were Mr. Adu and Mr. Chufa. There's nothing really in there. I just refer the court to our chronology, which is at the joint appendix.
Well, speaking of chronologies, counsel said that the conviction occurred before the 59E motion was filed, right?
I think he meant before the second one. Right?
Before the second one.
He's corrected at the time of the, and my mistake, I don't recall, but at the time of the first motion for reconsideration, it was triggered by the court's calculation of the filing fee. And the judge points out that was filed 14 days after the clerk made the calculation.
Right.
So I think the chronology with respect to the replies and the sir replies is correct. Although, of course, the argument was made when my client found out about the conviction and no later.
Well, here's the anomaly, though. You mentioned the prosecution in reply to the opposition to your motion for reconsideration. That was in August of 2008, first mention of it, and that was the first possible mention. The court then ordered the sir reply to your reply, and it mentions the prosecution of the Chufas in passing and mentions that the argument was raised in the reply. The court then dismisses the case without prejudice, right? And you make a renewed motion, but the renewed motion doesn't mention the conviction.
No. I don't know the answer to that.
Sounds like forfeiture at that point.
Well, I don't know why. I don't have the renewed motion in front of me, whether it incorporated previous arguments, but we certainly did raise the second time around the treatment of Mr. Chufa in the context of...
You raised it in the reply, your final filing with regard to the renewed motion, but not in the motion itself. So it's...
Although I suppose what I would say, Your Honor, is what of course was happening was the court's dismissal without prejudice was based on its decision, I think a correct one, to await the outcome from the Cameroonian court and then, again, to await the outcome of the written decision. So that was really the issue that was being focused on when the new filing took place. Can I just say one thing? I know I'm way over time. With respect to the ruling showing that the courts of the Cameroon are fair because they ruled for us. First of all, I would say that if Mr. Bemis is conceding the court in Cameroon ruled for us, that should, it seems to me, dispose of the issue of the filing fee, since that is what the trial court said it was waiting to hear in the first place. And there's nothing to suggest that the Cameroonian court was saying, having written 70 pages and having laid out all the arguments, even though we see all these arguments for reducing the filing fee, we're going to ignore them because they weren't made by the right party. Certainly, the defendant has standing to argue that no fees are assessed when it's the defendant. So the first thing I would say is, if Mr. Bemis is conceding that the court ruled our way, then it seems to me the ruling that the judge was waiting for disposes of the filing fee issue once and for all, no matter who made the arguments that the court rejected. The second thing I would say, Your Honor, is that the fairness of the Cameroonian courts under the circumstances took place while the American courts were watching. And if you read the opinion, you'll see it lays out in detail the allegations and the complaint and where it was filed. And my only, Your Honor, you asked me if we proceed with caution, and I do believe we proceed with caution in these cases. Wherever we're asking an American court to cast some aspersions on a brother or sister court, but my concern always is that it's not so much the sensitivities of individual justices we need to be concerned about, it's the sensitivities of the people of the Cameroon, who I believe look to American courts still for guidance and hope.
That was the longest single sentence since James Joyce.
I had one more clause, Your Honor, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say, I urge the court to reverse the trial court. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Toledo.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Bemis, thank you. Case is submitted.